the opportunity to spend some time with you this week talking about these great things of God. It is interesting to me to see how families kind of blend together. We have some connections that go back pretty far. My wife grew up in West Virginia with the Fields family, and so there's some connections that go pretty far and deep back with Lisa's kin. And that wasn't so much me because I was from California, but it's a different story. But we're grateful to be here with you now and thankful to be able to open up God's Word and talk about the things of God with you. I want to think about, if you'll be turning your Bibles to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. I want us to think about some issues that concern our faith and what that means to us. We're familiar with the passage in Hebrews 11 and verse 1 that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. That's from the New American Standard. And what we're facing today is a problem of redefinition. And when we try to talk to people in the world, trying to understand better how to communicate with people, I think one of the things we're going to be thinking about this week is how we can talk about faith, how we can talk about God and Scripture in ways that help us communicate better. Because I fear that sometimes when you hear the word faith and when someone from the world hears the word faith, you're probably thinking of two very different things. And we hear the same word, we hear the same sound, but we don't think the same thoughts. And as a result of that, we find ourselves miscommunicating. So when you come across some common ideas in the world, the idea, for example, that faith is believing in spite of or without evidence. Now, this is the way unbelievers will often define faith. And my fear is we hear that and we kind of take that as our definition. But I want you to know that that's not the biblical definition. And when we talk about having faith, we're not saying we're believing things in spite of evidence. But that's a common idea that you'll run into. Or that faith and reason are at odds with each other. And that if we're going to accept faith, we're just going to have to accept that it's not reasonable. And again, while the world wants to portray faith in that way, that's not the biblical concept of faith. Our concern as Christians is the biblical concept, is it not? Understand what the Scriptures say about that, and that's not it. God does not pit faith against reason. In fact, He shows that faith is the reasonable option. Or you might hear that faith is superstition, while science is knowledge. That if you're interested in knowledge, you'll go the route of science, because science doesn't involve faith. And that's just false. It's just not even a proper representation of what faith is or how science works with the concept of faith. Everybody has faith in something. Everybody does. And so our task is to, first of all, to kind of debunk some of these false concepts and establish a biblical working definition of faith. That when we talk about faith, what is it that we're actually talking about? What are we really dealing with? And of course, I want to encourage true faith in such a way that our lives reflect that sense of trust. And I would just encourage you to think about the word trust when you think about the word faith. We'll say more about this. But the idea that when you think faith, you have faith in God. What you're really saying is, I trust something to be true. So what is it that we're trusting to be true? Well, there's some other passages here. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6, we're familiar with this point, that without faith it is impossible to please Him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who seek Him. I believe that's the ESV. Faith, of course, then is prerequisite to being able to please God. But we have to believe that He is. We have to believe that He exists. And the second part of that tells us that there's a certain aspect about who God is that we have to accept. We're not just believing in any God here. We'll talk more about that tonight, Lord willing. Who is God? What are we talking about? Who are we talking about when we talk about God? But faith, of course, is necessary in order to please God. But again, that's not just saying I believe something is true. It's saying that I have trust in the reality of it in such a way that my life will reflect it. I love this account in John chapter 20. You recall that when Jesus, after the resurrection, appears to his disciples. And who is missing? Remember who wasn't there? Our Thomas wasn't there. So when the other disciples tell Thomas that we've seen Jesus, and Thomas says, I'm not going to believe unless I see it myself, unless I can see the scars or touch him, I'm not going to believe until then. By the way, the other disciples didn't believe it till they saw Jesus either. Because when the women were talking about seeing Jesus, they thought this was, you know, just made up. They didn't believe it. They didn't accept it until they saw Jesus. So they all kind of had this sense of, you know, faith can only be such that we have to first see Jesus in order to believe. And that's not what true faith really is. So when Thomas sees Jesus and then says in verse 28, my Lord and my God, really the only proper response, my Lord and my God, Jesus said in verse 29, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet have believed. Now, that's what's lying in the background of the next couple of verses. We're familiar with verses 30 and 31, I think, that tell us something of the purpose of the Gospel of John. But lying in the background of this is the fact that Thomas has just said, okay, my Lord and my God, I believe now. I've seen. Jesus says, you've seen because you've believed because you've seen. Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. So John tells us that his purpose is to write this so that you may believe, and you don't have to see it yourself. You don't have to see firsthand that the evidence can be testified to and documented in such a way that we are warranted in believing this, even though we have not firsthand, with our own eyes, seen Jesus. And then I want to note 1 Peter chapter 3, 13 through 15, taking a little bit different direction, but again, dovetailing into this idea of how we view faith and evidence. Peter is writing to those who were being persecuted or about to be persecuted, and he's telling them that they need to be prepared for that. And so he asks this question, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ as the Lord is holy, always being prepared to make a defense for anyone who asks you for a reason of the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So don't be troubled by what the world is going to say. Don't be troubled by what the world is going to do to you if you profess Jesus Christ. What we need to do, he says, is set Jesus apart in your heart as holy. Sanctify Christ, another translation would say. Sanctify him in your heart. Set him apart as holy. You've got to see Jesus as Lord before we can really move on forward from this. In other words, if you're going to give a proper defense of the gospel, it needs to be from a heart that recognizes the lordship of Jesus. And so he says you need to be then prepared to make a defense, or some translations say give a reason. That word there, by the way, is the word from which we get the word apology. And I know that when we hear the word apology today, what do we usually think of? I'm sorry. Let me apologize for something I did wrong. That's not what it meant here. Paul used the same term in Philippians 1, 16 and 17 when he says, I'm set for the defense for the apology of the gospel. And so apology in that context is a verbal defense of something. So in the ancient world, when they gave an apology, it wasn't saying, I'm sorry. It was saying, I'm going to defend this. So we're prepared or need to be prepared to defend what? He says, the reason for the hope that is in you. Doesn't mean you have an answer for anything and everything. It just means that you understand why you have a hope. And you're willing to defend that. You're willing to talk about that. We're going to dovetail that into the resurrection later on. But he says you do it with gentleness and respect. So let me come back then to the definition of what we're talking about here with faith. I'm coming back to Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And some translations there say the evidence of things not seen. And it's not uncommon for us to take that and say, see, what that's saying is faith has evidence to it, and that's why. But that's not really the point of Hebrews 11, 1. What Hebrews 11, 1 is telling us is that, first of all, faith stands under our hope. If we're going to have hope, it's because we have faith. In other words, you can't really have hope unless you first have faith. And there's so many passages that talk about our hope. Once again, we're born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, 4 says. So we have hope, but we have that hope because we have faith. And then he says it's the conviction of things not seen. So in other words, what we're saying about faith is we are convicted about things that we cannot visibly see. And so what I'm saying is, if I'm going to kind of define faith, it's this idea that faith stands under hope and demonstrates our conviction and trust in the reality of what we cannot see. So if we can't see something, the question is, are we warranted in believing that it is real or that it exists or that we can trust this? We cannot see God with our eyes. In other words, we can see evidence of God. But no one has seen God in the fullest sense, certainly. Jesus came to explain God, John chapter 1 teaches us. And so through Jesus you see God. But even then, we weren't there. We didn't visibly see Jesus with our own eyes. We trust the testimony that has been passed down, but that's part of the point. It takes trust to accept that. But as we'll see as we talk more about this, there are some things about faith that I think is pretty common that we all accept, that everybody has faith in something. But let's think about the reasonable nature of this. Is faith reasonable? And again, some are going to pit faith against reason and say, no, if you have faith, you don't have reason. If you have reason, you don't have faith. Of course, they don't stop and ask, do I have faith in my own reasoning abilities? Which they obviously do. But they have faith in something. So there is a reasonable nature about this. And I would suggest to you that there are three things that really are necessary if we're going to have what would be called a reasonable faith. Now, and it is possible to have an unreasonable faith. In other words, it is possible to believe things in spite of evidence. But that's not what we're talking about here. First, I would suggest to you that there is a needed understanding of what it is that we're talking about. Let me go back to Acts chapter 17 for just a moment. Paul goes into the city of Athens, and we're dropping down to verse 19, where they take Paul. Paul goes in the city of Athens, and there's these, basically it's filled with philosophers, but it's also filled with a lot of idols and altars. And they would gather at the Areopagus, Mars Hill, and they only wanted to hear new things, right? Now, Mars Hill is interesting because if you go to Mars Hill even today, you can go there, you can visit there, maybe some of you have. You go up on top of Mars Hill and you see the ruins of ancient Athens. And you look up one side and you see the Parthenon and the Temple of Nike and some other temples up there on top of the hill. And you can kind of trace it down and follow the road down through. And you see the ruins of idols and altars all down through there. And you come down to the bottom of the hill where there's the Temple of Vulcan. You're looking at a city even today that there's filled with evidence of idolatry. And so they take Paul up on to Mars Hill, and he's going to talk to them about what he calls the unknown God. Here's this altar to the unknown God. Let me talk to you about him. And incidentally, that may be the approach we need to take today. When people talk about God, are they really talking about the same God we're talking about? We'll ask that question tonight. But Paul says, I'm going to talk to you about this unknown God. This is the God who made the world and all things in it. Verse 24, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. Now here's my point. When Paul talks about God, he has some understanding of who he's talking about. If we're going to have a reasonable faith, there needs to be some level of understanding of what we're doing, what we're talking about, who we're talking about. If you're going to talk about Jesus Christ to somebody, you need to have some understanding of who he is. Who is he? What did he do? Why did he do it? If you're going to talk about why you're a Christian, you need to know why you are. Why am I a Christian? Why did I decide to do this? And not just, well, I did it because my parents told me to. You're doing it because you're owning your own faith. We need some understanding of what we're talking about. And that otherwise, it becomes an unreasonable thing. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know who I'm talking about, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. Well, that's not the way the Lord would have us work. There needs to be some readiness to act. And you're familiar with James chapters 1 and 2. And the whole point that James is making about the fact that we need to act upon our faith. Be doers of the word, not merely hearers, deluding your own selves, he said. Or we become like the person who looks at his face in a mirror and turns around, walks away, and forgets what he looks like. We need to be reflective in the sense that we're thinking about who we are and what we are and what we're doing. And chapter 2 goes into this point about the idea that you can't just simply say to somebody, be warmed and filled. You need to act. Because faith without works is dead, he says. So the kind of faith we're talking about then is not simply a mental assent to something. Just to say, well, I believe something to be the case, and it doesn't really affect my life. There are some things I could say I believe, and yet all I really mean by that is, I kind of have a hunch that maybe I might be correct because I heard this at some point in my life, but I'm not really sure. And if I'm proven to be false on this, that's okay. It doesn't really change anything for me. I could say, well, I believe that Alexander the Great lived in the 4th century B.C., and if some evidence came along that proved that it was the 3rd century, that's not a big life-changing thing for me. You know what I'm saying? And I might even say, well, I believe the earth is so many miles from the sun, and somebody says, oh, no, you missed it by, well, okay, that doesn't really affect my life. But there are some things. What you put your trust in will change everything about your life. And this is one of them, the gospel, Jesus Christ, the resurrection. We need to be ready to act on that. We can't just simply say, I think maybe, okay, I believe Jesus was raised from the dead. Now let me go do what I want to do. Once you accept that truth, everything in your life changes. And it ought to. We need to be ready to act on it. And there needs to be a reason for that acceptance. We've already mentioned 1 Peter 3:15, giving a reason for the hope that is in you. And we need to have some reason that we're talking about this, not just simply say, if somebody asks, why do you believe? And your answer is, well, I don't know, just because. That's not going to be a persuasive answer. It's not going to be something that's going to endear people to the faith. Because if I ask somebody that question about something and they say, I don't know, I just believe it, that's not going to persuade me to say, oh, well, okay, I'll believe it too then. That's not the way that works. There needs to be some reason for that. I love the point in John chapter 6 that when Jesus is talking there to his disciples, of course, he's just talked about the fact that he's the bread of life who's come down out of heaven. He is the manna of God. And then he said, you're going to have to eat my flesh and drink my blood if you're going to have life. And they misunderstood what he meant. The Gospel of John, by the way, is filled with all kinds of misunderstandings. That's one of the themes of it. People misunderstand Jesus. And here he is making that statement. They misunderstand him. They're offended by that. They turn and walk away. He turns to his disciples and he says, are you going to go away too? And Peter, in one of his brilliant moments, makes this point in John 6 and verse 68. Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. We have a reason to stay with you, Jesus. We've seen who you are. We've seen what you do. We may not fully understand it, but we see what you do, and we accept that. There's a reason for staying with Jesus. And that's what our faith needs to be. Reasonable. And so faith involves an intellect. Don't think that, you know, faith is non-intellectual. We are to love God with all our minds. And that means learning to use our minds well, use our minds properly. There's an intellectual aspect to who we are, that God gave us brains. He gave us minds to learn how to think and reason. And he's not saying, I gave you minds to think and reason, but don't use it when you believe in me. No, the whole point is to be able to use it in our faith. And so the use of the mind is critical. But there's also an emotional side to us. And we're not saying here that faith needs to be devoid of all emotion, that faith needs to just be some kind of robotic response or something like that. There is a sensitive reaction that we have when we come to understand who Jesus is and what he has done. We ought to be emotionally affected by what we see in Scripture, by what we see God has done, by the love of God through Jesus Christ. When Jesus goes to the cross, we ought to be emotionally affected by that. And we can't be afraid of that part of it. But that's not enough. Even these two things together are not enough. I have sat across table with people who have said, I accept this intellectually. I see that this is true. I know that this is right. Emotionally, they're affected by it. I've seen them weep and cry, knowing that this is the truth, and yet not do anything else about it. Well, it shouldn't surprise us. James 2 and verse 19, you believe that God is one, and you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. The demons have an intellectual faith. The demons had an emotional faith. They shuddered at the truth of who Jesus was. They were the ones who looked at Jesus and said, we know you're the Holy One of God. But who's going to argue they were saved? Intellect and emotion require the will to put it into practice, to do something about it. But even as we talk about this, there are some things that faith does not require. I don't want us to think that when we say faith requires certain things, that it requires everything. It doesn't. In fact, it does not require that we understand everything that there is. If you were to ask me, can you understand everything about God? Absolutely not. In fact, I love the point in Ephesians 3 and verse 20. God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything we can ask or think. Now let that sink in for just a second, because that's a passage we'll come back to this week. God is able to do what we are incapable of thinking. Do we think we can understand all that? Not going to happen. And so faith doesn't require that we understand everything. But we don't operate on that basis anyway, do we? How many of you fully understand everything about your spouse if you're married? I mean, you know everything about it. Look, you know, men and women are different, right? And there are some things that, you know, even after many years of marriage, you say, I still don't exactly understand that. But, okay, you trust them. You trust them anyway. How many of you fully understand? And I'm usually there's somebody in an audience who does this, knows this. If I ask the question, who understands everything about a car? You can take it apart. You know everything. But you could, you know, remove the engine, rebuild it. You can do all that with it. Anybody here do that? Occasionally I run into, you know, somebody who is a mechanic, and that's what they do. Good, fine. Most of us don't. Does that keep you from driving it? Well, I don't understand everything about this car, so I'm not going to drive it anymore. What about a computer? Somebody here might understand everything about a computer. Take it apart, put it back together, all the components, all the pieces, all that. Most of us don't, but some do. That's just what they do. I don't, but that doesn't stop me from using it. We don't look at that and say, well, I don't understand everything about this, so I'm not going to use it. No. That's not the way faith works. Faith doesn't require that we understand everything. We need to know certain things, but not everything. And nor does it require that we understand the why of everything. And Job is a perfect example of this. You know, you read the book of Job and you realize that Job doesn't understand why he's suffering. That's why he's questioning. He doesn't understand it. The friends think they understand it, but they don't. So when God speaks up in Job 38, what does he say? Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? In other words, you guys have no idea what you're talking about. You have no clue. You weren't there when I created. You don't understand how I operate and how I work. And God's answer to Job was not, okay, Job, let me explain everything to you about why you're suffering. It's not what he did. What he did was he basically said, Job, you're just going to have to trust me. And there are certain things we just have to end up saying, I don't know the why and the wherefore, and that's okay. I can still trust God. I liken it to a child with a parent. You know, when you're dealing with toddlers especially, and while there are certain things that as parents we try to explain to our children when they're little, as they're growing, and you know, we try to give them some understanding of what's happening and in this world and all that, but there is a point, you know, we all said it before we became parents, we would say, I'm never going to say that to my kids. And when you have kids, you say it. You're just going to have to trust me. Why should I do this? Because I'm your dad and I said so. You know, because we realize that that parents have a knowledge base and an understanding that the toddler doesn't have. And if you tried to explain it, they're not going to get it. Not yet. Sometime they will, but not yet. So that knowledge gap between the child and the parent is huge. How much greater the knowledge gap between us and God? We don't have to understand all the whys, nor do we have to physically see everything. John 20 and verse 29, again, blessed are those who haven't seen yet have believed. So what we're talking about, really, it's kind of like going into a court of law. You know, you think about the various types of evidences that work in a court of law. You have documents. You have eyewitnesses, accounts. And by the way, if you're on a jury, that means you're not an eyewitness. If you were an eyewitness, you wouldn't be on the jury. You'd be an eyewitness, you know, giving testimony. And so you, as a juror, are expected to listen to the testimony, look at the evidence, make some conclusions about that. Usually it's a cumulative case. It's not just here's one piece of evidence and one piece only. It's this piece and this piece and this piece and this piece. And you make a cumulative case, put it all together. And we draw an inference to the best explanation so that the jury can make a decision about what they believe happened. Even though they didn't see it, they can still, and in our court system, we recognize the ability of a jury to draw a conclusion about what happened when they themselves did not see that thing happen. It's built into the system, but that's the way it works. And it becomes unreasonable doubt. You know, when the evidence is just piled on so much, it becomes unreasonable to doubt. And that's why they call it beyond a reasonable doubt. But it's as in historical matters. You know, when you think about any matters historically, we weren't there, yet we trust the reality of it. So if you doubt that, let me give you a quiz question here. Who was first president of the United States of America? Anybody know that answer? How do you know that answer? Were you there? Anybody there present? You know, anybody see the tag on the first several presidents, Washington and on? I mean, were you anybody there? Yet we trust the reality of that because there's documentation, there are eyewitnesses, there are accounts that bring us to that conclusion, and the evidence is overwhelming, and it would be pretty unreasonable to doubt that. Some manage to doubt it anyway, but you know, we got to be reasonable. And I find that that's true even in our own personal families. Now, if I ask you, were you there when you were born? Of course you were, but how many of you remember that event? You know, if I were really wanting to be a true skeptic about everything, we could throw some wrenches in that. You know, are you sure? You know who your mom is? And how do you know you weren't switched at birth? And how do you know things weren't tampered with? And, you know, because that has happened. I mean, that has happened at some point. Let me ask you this. How many of you have had the DNA testing to prove that your parents are your parents? I have. Not because I was skeptical of my mother, but my mom is really into genealogies. And that's what she does. And she called me up one day and she says, I need you to get a DNA test. I'm sending the kit to you. I said, well, Mom, I don't want to go into the system. But it's Mom, so I did it. And sure enough, you know, no doubt about it. But you see my point? You don't feel like you have to go through a bunch of hoops to trust what your parents were telling you. Unless there's a reason, some overriding reason that you've been given not to accept the truth of that. Why would you doubt that? So we open up the Gospels, and this is what we find. Luke chapter 1. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Whatever else you want to think about the gospel accounts, and I've talked to unbelievers about this very point. I said, look, whatever you think about the gospel account, I know you think it's fiction. I understand that. But you cannot open this gospel and say Luke's intent was to write fiction. Can't do it. We have to give some credibility to the intent of the author. And Luke is very clear here. I'm talking about things that have been accomplished, he says. Things that have eyewitnesses from the very beginning, and things that have been delivered down, and things that I have followed closely or investigated carefully, some translations indicate. And I want you to have a certainty about the things that have happened. That's what Luke says is his purpose. And we have to grapple with that if we're going to, you know, recognize the nature of ancient writings. Luke says, I'm writing this to talk about what really happened. Now, you can say, I'm not going to believe that, but you can't say their intent was to write a myth, because it wasn't. In a biblical approach to evidence, we see that Jesus himself pointed to evidence. There's a number of places where Jesus did this. John 5, he pointed to at least five separate witnesses about him, including the scriptures, including Moses. In Matthew 11 and verse 4, when John the Baptist had been imprisoned, and he sent the disciples to Jesus, and he says, I want you to make sure, is he the coming one? Is he the expected one, or should we be looking for someone else? And Jesus told the disciples of John, you go tell John the things that you hear and see. In other words, look at the evidence. Don't just say, well, okay, he said so, therefore, well, even Jesus recognized that as he was giving his own testimony, he needed to provide extra witnesses for the people to accept the truth of that. And so you have other passages. I'm going to talk more about Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 later this morning, so I'll not go into detail there. But in 1 John chapter 1, how many times did John say, we saw, we heard, we touched, we saw, we heard, we touched? It's very clear. The evidence was provided. Peter in 2 chapter 1, 16 and 17, says, talking about the transfiguration, he says, we were not bringing you a bunch of myths and fables. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And so my point is that as in every area of life, every other area of life, we accept the way this works. These pieces of the puzzle fit together to help us provide a sense of certainty about what it is that we accept. Everyone has faith in something. It's not about scientific testing, and that by itself requires a level of faith, by the way. Because to do scientific testing, you have to have trust that your senses are giving you good information. You have to be able to trust that the tests you're doing are adequate to provide for the issues that are at hand. There's a bunch of things that go into that, and even that requires a level of faith. So let me just end with this, coming back full circle to the point we started with. Faith is the evidence. In this case, it is the evidence that you accept the reality of what you can't see. If you accept the truth about God, you accept the truth about Jesus, even though you haven't laid eyes on him firsthand, you can trust the reality of that. And so, I think about what Peter said, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6, after he's talked about the fact that we're born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus. We obtain this inheritance, which is imperishable and undefiled, will not fade away, verse 4 says, reserved in heaven for you, who are protected by the power of God through faith for salvation to be revealed in the last time. He says, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been distressed by various trials. Now notice, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. We walk by faith, not by sight. That doesn't mean we walk without any evidence. It doesn't mean we walk blindly. It just means that the basis of our faith is not that we have to firsthand see everything ourselves. We can trust the evidence that God has provided in this world and through the scriptures. So think about the nature of faith. And when you're talking with an unbeliever, don't let the unbeliever define the term for you. Let scripture define it. That's what we're defending. Is not some convoluted concept of faith out here in the world, but the kind of faith scriptures talk about. I appreciate your time, and we'll pick up with these thoughts a little bit later this morning.